From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in.
And joining us this morning for the first half of the show is Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, named one of the nation's most effective communicators on climate change by the New York Times, and also, of course, a climate scientist herself. She is the author of the recent book, Saving Us, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope and Healing in a Divided World, and is also speaking locally here at Utah Clean Energy's annual fundraiser tomorrow, October 6th. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
So I have to ask as our first question, you know, are obviously a climate scientist. How does a climate scientist come to spend their career focusing so much on climate communication rather than on climate science? Like, what kind of shifted that focus for you?
Well, it happened completely organically, and I should say that I still do climate science today. It just isn't something that I talk about quite as much outside the scientific community. But I study what climate change means to people in the places where they live. So I specifically look at how climate change affects our health, our infrastructure, the amount of snow that we have on the mountains to ski, the quality of the air that we breathe, things that directly affect us. So about 15 years ago, I moved to Texas. And where I live, I am the only climate scientist within about a 200-mile radius. So it was just a few months after I arrived that I got my first invitation to speak, and I still remember it, to a women's group about climate change. And I thought to myself, well, everybody needs to know about this. The reason I'm studying climate change myself is because it affects every single human on this planet. So I would love to talk to them about it. So I went, and I discovered that people had a lot of questions. Who wouldn't have questions these days with all the conflicting information you hear in the news and in the media? But they were genuinely interested and they wanted to know, why did it matter? So that was when I realized, you know what? We aren't talking about this issue. It affects everybody, yet hardly anybody. Even 2 weeks ago, a new survey showed 14% of people are talking about climate change. I thought to myself, it's like, imagine if nobody talked about COVID. That's the scale of the risk that we're facing. But we're not talking about it.
And why do you think that is? I mean, it's become in this country so divisive, right? To talk about climate change, you know, it's, you know, you're good, I'm bad, vice versa, that kind of thing. What kind of strategies have you found to kind of overcome that? Certainly living in a traditionally conservative state, although, clean energy is a big thing over there. What have you found to be effective in your work, your research? In kind of reaching across the aisle, reaching across, you know, the community to get people to find some common ground and interest?
Well, often we don't talk about it, first of all, because we don't want to start an argument or pick a fight, or because it's just a real downer. I mean, who wants to know even more about how Antarctica is melting and how sea level is rising? And honestly, when I think about those things all the time, I just want to go back to bed and pull the blanket up over my head, too. So ironically, the secret is to start from the heart rather than the head, to start with why it matters and what we can do about it, rather than doom-filled facts about what's happening at the pole. So, for example, you know, we could have conversations over something we love doing, like skiing, something that we're really passionate about, like our children, for example, something that we're concerned about, like the smog that hangs over Salt Lake City. Start the conversation with something that matters to you and matters to the person or people you're talking with. And if you don't know what matters to them, then ask them questions and get to know them first before you start to talk about what you're worried about. But then always connect it to a positive, constructive solution. It could be something that you do yourself in your home or your family, but it could also be something that the city is doing, something that the state is doing, something that a company is doing or that the church is doing. There's so many positive examples that show us that this giant boulder of climate action is not sitting at the bottom of a steep hill with only a few hands on it that will never get it up the hill. It is literally, it's already at the top of the hill. It's already rolling down in the right direction. It's got millions of hands on it. It just needs to go faster.
One of the interesting things that I think you've pointed out is that while we're not talking about it, most people in the U.S. understand that climate change is actually happening, right?
Yes. And in fact, a new survey just came out from Yale University showing that 70% of people in the United States are worried about climate change. Yet we are not talking about it because we don't know how. So that's exactly why I wrote my new book called Saving Us, because it's not about saving the planet. It is literally about us, and it's up to all of us. And how do we start this process? We have to start it by using our voices to talk about why it matters, to talk about what's been done to fix it, and then to talk about how we can add our hands to that boulder to get it going just a little bit faster.
I love that title because I think you're obviously totally right. We often talk about it in terms of other things that maybe seem a little bit more disconnected. We talk about it as it relates to, you know, the coral reefs or, you know, endangered species, but maybe not how it'll impact our own lives. And it's interesting. You said 70% of people are worried about it. Is that right?
Yes, 70% according to a new Yale study.
I guess I wouldn't have guessed that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and what, 12% are talking about it? It seems like an obvious disconnect there. Do you see pockets of opportunity? I mean, one thing that I found interesting of just, you know, learning about you and the work that you do is that you're from a faith-based background, that's something that you talk about and put out there, which I think some people are reluctant to bring their faith into it. But are you seeing advancement, kind of inroads being made within the faith community? Because that's traditionally where in this country we see reservations or more kind of conservative outlooks on the environment and kind of so-called liberal values.
We definitely see that here in the United States. But when you dig into what causes white evangelical Protestants and white Catholics to be at the very bottom of the list of the least concerned people about climate change, it turns out it's not where you go to church or what you believe theologically. It's the association with politics. Over the last few decades, there have been deliberate and very successful attempts to conflate conservative theology with conservative political ideology. And these attempts go back so far that Billy Graham warned about these back in the 1970s. He was like, beware of right-wing politics because they don't actually share your values. They just want to use you, he said. Well, fast forward until now, and you realize that that's exactly what's happened. For many people, unfortunately, their statement of faith is written primarily by their political ideology and only a very distant second by what the Bible or by what their faith actually says. And if the two come into conflict, they will go with politics over the Bible. And in fact, when they surveyed people coming out of the polls at the second last presidential election, when President Trump was elected, they asked people, did you vote for President Trump? And then they said, do you consider yourself to be evangelical? And then of the people who said yes to both, they asked them one more question. They said, do you go to church? And if so, how often? 50% said they never go to church.
Wow. Interesting. Yet they identify as religious people. They just don't practice what they preach, I guess.
Right. So how would they even know what they believe?
Right. Right.
You know what I mean? Like, how do you find out what you believe if you never go to church or you never, you know? So I mean, of course, it's not the be-all and end-all. There are many other ways that we can learn about what we believe. You don't have to show up every single weekend. But the point is that we have confused. It's sort of like, I, as a Christian, think of it as, in the Bible, it says, you're like somebody who looked in the mirror and then went away and forgot who you are. Hmm. I feel like that's what a lot of us are like, because when you look in other countries, when you look in England, the Archbishop of Canterbury, when you look at the World Evangelical Alliance, who I represented as their climate ambassador, they are leading the charge on climate action in the name of justice, in the name of love, and in the name of being good stewards of this amazing planet that God has given to us.
How did this happen? Like, how did this become so polarized? Why did these sort of evangelical Christian values get maybe confused or associated with conservative political values?
Well, no one wakes up in the morning and says that I want to reject 200 years of physics, including the physics that just won the Nobel Prize this morning. Literally.
So
two climate modelers, an atmospheric modeler and an ocean modeler, they won the Nobel Prize this morning. And most people don't wake up and say, well, I've decided to reject everything that, you know, that explains why airplanes fly and why stoves heat food and what won the Nobel Prize. But what do we do in the morning? We wake up and, except for yesterday, obviously, when Facebook was down, we scroll through the social media feeds of the people who we agree with. We listen to the pundits and the politicians and the thought leaders whose values we agree with. And we are all, every single one of us, you and me, as well as everybody else, we're all cognitive misers. We don't have time to find out all the intricate details of every single issue that's being discussed in the public square. So instead, we go with whatever opinions people we trust have, and then we just use our brain to look for reasons to explain why we're right. And so that's how this came about. People who hold the balance of power and wealth in this world, the 90 companies that are responsible for 2/3 of heat-trapping gas emissions since the dawn of the industrial era, many of them decided at some point, you know what, sure, this is a problem, but it's better for our bottom line if people keep on using fossil fuels. So we're going to invest. We're going to invest in think tanks to muddy the waters. We're going to invest in attacking climate scientists like me. And there's a really good book and documentary called Merchants of Doubt that explains all of this. And we're going to invest in politicians so that they see that it's in their best interest to continue to further fossil fuel use. And so that's exactly what they did. And that's what's ended us up in this situation today.
Do you see reason for hope? I mean, you seem to be an optimistic person. You know, I feel like, and I think you say this in your bio, you know, the planet will survive. It's really, will we survive with it? So do you see that there are places that we can look for hope and, you know, against these mega, you know, multi-billion dollar corporations, you know, we as average citizens, where do you find hope and optimism as you look at this bigger picture?
Well, again, that is exactly why I wrote my book, Saving Us, because the number one question I get every day, literally every day, is what gives you hope? And so that's why I wrote the book, is because that's what we're looking for. And I feel like if a climate scientist can find hope, can't we all? Mm-hmm. So in the book, I talk about how, first of all, there is hope in knowing that our choices matter today more than ever. The future is literally in our hands. The choices that we collectively make will determine our outcome. The world that we live in ourselves as well as our children. It isn't just about future generations anymore. It's now and it's here. I also find hope in recognizing, again, that that giant boulder of climate action is not sitting at the bottom of the cliff with only a few hands on it. When we start to look around, when we start to say, oh, well, what's Salt Lake City doing? What's Park City doing? What are the different ski resorts doing? What are some of the big industries doing? What is, you know, what's happening at the state level? How much clean energy do we have? What are different churches doing? We start to see that hope is everywhere, that churches are acting. And in fact, I just got an amazing, when I start to look for hope, which I do, I actively look for hope because you have to go out and look for it. It doesn't find you. just this morning, let me just share it, my hope with you from this morning. So the Presbyterian Church of Ireland just decided to divest their investments and their holdings from fossil fuels. They just voted to do so today. And in doing so, and this literally brought tears to my eyes, they quoted from the book.
Wow.
They quoted from Saving Us, and they said, and here's what I said that they quoted, climate change is not only an environmental issue. Climate change is a poverty issue. It's a hunger issue. It's an issue of inequality and injustice. And to us as Christians, that speaks to us. And so the moderator who was asking the General Assembly to divest went on to say, you know, for us as a church to actually profit from something that's causing so much harm hinders our abilities as Christians to be responsible stewards and to love others. And so, you know, when you start to look for action, it truly is everywhere. And when we share this with people, we realize, wow, if that giant boulder is already moving down the hill in the right direction and it's already got millions of hands on it, if I add my hand, it could make a tiny bit of a difference. And then if I could encourage my neighborhood, my child's school, my place of work, if I could, you know, encourage my city to lend their hand, the boulder could go even faster. We truly can make a difference. And how does it all begin? It all begins by using our voices, the one thing we're not doing.
Well, that's so incredibly powerful. And I had goosebumps when you were talking about the actions and the words of the Church of Ireland, because it does give such hope. I'm curious how something like that translates to home here in the United States, or specifically to your home in Texas. I think, you know, maybe in the rest of the country, we think about Texas as a very politically conservative, very religious place. What do you see happening in Texas all around you?
Mm-hmm. Well, Texas in many ways is the perfect place to be a climate scientist. I live in Lubbock, which According to one poll, is the second most conservative city in the whole country. Number one is Provo.
Oh, right here at home. Yes. Okay.
Yes. And I should add that the BYU has some really amazing people doing fantastic work on climate change, too. So Provo is a great place to be, too. As we do in Logan, as we do in Salt Lake City, there's so many people across Utah, too. So here in Texas, Texas is the most vulnerable state in the country to climate impact, because the biggest way climate change is affecting us is by loading the weather dice against us, making our hurricanes stronger, our heat waves more intense, our droughts more damaging and longer, our heavy rainfall more frequent, and Texas gets it all. Texas, of course, is also historically home to the oil and gas industry, but Texas has more wind energy than any other state, and they're currently number two in solar, but they're building the biggest solar farm in the country just outside of Dallas right now. And then you've got cities, not just Austin, but you've also got cities like Dallas and Houston and San Antonio and even El Paso that are taking serious action to prepare for the impacts of climate change and to transition to clean energy, to conserve water, to take all kinds of actions that are needed to tackle climate change. So Texas really is sort of the perfect place to be, because it's where often people are most resistant to what they might perceive to be a liberal issue. But when we start talking about how, and I have lots of Texas stories in my book, when we start, and I had Utah stories too, just to be very clear.
Excellent.
When we start talking about how it's a water issue, how it's a crop issue, how it's a health issue, how it's a city issue, how it's an energy issue, then all of a sudden people are like, oh, well, obviously I care about that. And by connecting over something that we both care about, that's how we can move forward together.
Well, in the last couple minutes of our conversation with you, you know, what do you think our goals should be? Where should we look in the next few years?
That depends on, do you mean like individually or as a city or state or as a world?
You know, I guess I was thinking as a world, but if it makes more sense to think about as an individual, you know, what should we hope for in the next year? What should I do in the next year? Talk us through that.
Well, we have a big climate meeting coming up in Glasgow the first 2 weeks of November, where all the countries show up, and it's sort of like a global potluck dinner. Everybody puts their contribution to the Paris Agreement on the table, and it turns out that some people, a few of them, are bringing everything they promised to bring, and then some people are bringing, you know, a year-old frozen apple pie from the back of the freezer that will only feed half of the people they promised, and then some people are bringing something that looks super nice, and you cut into it, and there's nothing in it. It's just smoke and mirrors. So that's what's happening in November. All of the countries really need to up their contribution. What's happening here in the U.S.? Here in the U.S., in the next couple of weeks, Congress is going to be voting on the biggest piece of climate legislation we are going to see this decade. So if you want to use your voice in an incredibly effective way the next couple of weeks, call your elected representative and say, look, we need climate action. A thermometer does not knock on your door and ask who you voted, or sorry, a wildfire does not knock on your door and ask who you voted for before it burns down your house. We need climate action that's good for everyone. Please vote for the budget and the infrastructure bills. That's something we can do immediately. But what else can we do longer term? We can consider that we're not just an individual. We're part of a school or a business, a place of work. We may belong to a church. We may belong to another type of congregation. We live in a certain place. Every single one of us has a voice that we can use to say, hey, look what that they over there are doing. Maybe we could do it too. Look what that organization or that school or that business or that church is doing. Why don't we do that too? Use our voice to affect change in the places where we live and bring other people on board, because that's the only way that the world has ever changed before, is when individual people, not big, rich, famous, important people, but individual, ordinary people decide it has to and it must.
Well, Catherine, it is so inspiring to hear you speak. And for listeners who might be interested in hearing more from you, you are speaking locally here in Utah for Utah Clean Energy's annual fundraiser tomorrow at a virtual event, right?
I am. I'm so excited to do that.
Fantastic. I think all the information for that is on Utah Clean Energy's website. And I know that Katie and I are looking forward to hearing more from you.
Fantastic. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again for joining us this morning. And we're looking forward to seeing you tomorrow.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.